Friends, this is Alvaro with the channel Uniquely Mary, and here we have Daniel Gallagher. I want to give him a chance to introduce himself, to tell us a little bit about who he is, and some of the many things that he has to share with us about Pope Francis. So tell us a little bit about your background, and how did you get this this opportunity to work with Pope Francis and maybe with others?
Yes, it's a pleasure to be with you, Alvaro. Thank you for the invitation. I worked first for Pope Benedict for about 7 years, I suppose. I started my service at the Holy See in 2007 and continued until and through his resignation until Bergoglio was elected as Francis, and then continued to work for him until just about the end of 2016. Now, how I ended up there with Benedict, at the time, I was a diocesan Catholic priest. I've been dispensed at my own request. Insufficient discernment as far as marriage goes led to the very extraordinary, unusual, and certainly not ideal situation where I had to go through a process, which I did, and Francis was generous in listening to my case and granting me that. But I was summoned there basically as a member of the clergy, and with the agreement of my own bishop at the time, who had received a direct request for my services. So it was a really unbelievable experience, of course, something I never expected in my entire life, especially to have served two popes and to have served through that transition period, which was highly unusual in its own right. Francis was an individual, just to share my personal perspective, especially having already assumed duties and having had some experience, not extensive, but I suppose at least almost 7 years working for the Holy See, was that Benedict was a man, Benedict XVI, a man whom I had known thoroughly through my studies. I had studied theology, I'd read all of his books, and he was a standard reading, let's say. So that by the time that I began to work for him, I knew him at least through his books and so on quite well, and I was very intimidated because I knew of his brilliance as a theologian, as a thinker, as an intellectual. And it's true that we may not see another individual of that caliber intellectually for years to come in the shoes of Peter. But then when Francis was elected, I had met him once, I think. And even those who were higher ranking officials, of course, in the Roman Curia didn't know him that well. And that was somewhat similar to John Paul II when Carlo Wojtyla was elected. He had not had any really direct Roman curial experience. And so Francis was a man whom people needed to get to know. And quite honestly, he had a great burden and a challenge of trying to get to know the Curia and the people who worked for him. That was quite a challenge. And that put me, again, personally in a very different position, because if I could make a contrast, when I first was introduced to Benedict as one of his staffers, and I had met him a couple of times before, he wouldn't have really recognized me that I know of. It's others that do the work on his behalf. But I just remember being overwhelmed. And then I remember seeing that in Francis's eyes the day after he was elected and he came to greet his staff, as that he was overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. That arose in my heart a great sense of sympathy to be in the position that he was in. I don't envy it, and I don't think anybody should, because all of a sudden you literally go from being just another black cassock with red piping on the street to stepping on the balcony into being in white. And I will say that I think that that was a burden that Francis had to carry, which he never really felt comfortable with, and honestly had made mistakes along the way. That's not necessarily to either excuse him, but to say that it's quite understandable. And I don't really have a solution for that. In other words, for someone who comes in from the outside, has no experience with the Roman Curia, maybe even limited administrative experience in general, and all of a sudden is in charge of the billions of Catholics throughout the world and is recognized as the head of a sovereign state and all of that entails, I will dare say that I don't know who will emerge from this next conclave as Pope, but the same challenge could very well be there, and maybe even more acutely with whoever that might be. I also want to say, Alvaro, that I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing to be challenged in that way. But I do think that institutionally the church has to find ways to assist someone who steps into that role in a lot of ways unprepared. And I don't know what that entails specifically, but I really have confidence that those kinds of things will develop in the years to come, because it's going to be more frequent that we will have a pope from outside the Roman curial system, from some faraway place, who has to carry the rein, take up the reins, and he needs more assistance than currently we have to give him.
Yeah. I think sometimes maybe people think that someone that gets elected pope is just going to have all this knowledge and all these gifts. They're just going to have all the tools, like it's just going to fall from the sky. And sometimes people will hear this phrase of Roman Curia. How would you describe what the Roman Curia is in a nutshell to someone maybe listening that maybe has heard the phrase, but they're not sure what does that mean?
So the Roman Curia is a complex of offices that is at the complete service of the Pope to carry out his ministry to the universal church, because the Pope is, as most would know, of course, primarily the Bishop of Rome. And that has its own apparatus to carry out the administrative functions, pastoral functions, evenly in the name of whoever the Pope is as the Bishop of Rome. The Roman Curia is that, again, system of offices that's there to help him in the day-to-day service to the entire universal church. I believe, depending on how you measure it, it's the largest such bureaucratic administrative state system in the world, simply because the Catholic Church is the largest body that has a single organizing principle like the Holy Father. Now, being as large as it is, that is why it can be prone to all kinds of problems of oversight, abuse, and it is, much of which has been brought out to the public. I dare say Catholics, hold on and grasp your faith, because more is going to come out. It just inevitably does. The Roman Curia, for all of that, I don't want to sound too negative, because it's necessary, absolutely necessary for all that the Pope has to do. It's imperfect, there are certainly pockets in which it shines with even holiness. And I can go through individuals that I know. I met saints working within that Roman Curia, who dedicated their lives to something that was very arduous, thankless, and they did it with a complete heart of charity and service. They were beacons for me in the hardest of times. So it's not thoroughly imbued with let's say, certainly malicious, so to speak, backbiting or something like that, as sometimes it's portrayed to be. But that does exist by human nature. But that's basically what the Roman Curia is. Now, I'll be more specifically, just briefly, that my role within that was when the office, which is called the Secretariat of State, which is that office which is basically closest to the Holy Father and keeping in touch with three things: the church, in other words, all correspondence that comes even from one's great-grandmother living in Palo Alto, who writes to the Pope, will get a response somehow through the Secretariat of State. So the church, the world. So the Secretariat of State is the office of the Roman Curia that's responsible for the diplomatic relations with all the other states, welcoming heads of state. I was involved with preparing for state visits of President Obama and President Trump and so on. And then also the Roman Curia. So in other words, the Secretariat of State is kind of that, for lack of a better word, the filter through which a lot of the business of the Congregation for Bishops, the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, the Congregation for Religious Evangelization of Peoples, so on, it gets to the Holy Father's desk through the Secretariat of State. So it's a lot of work. It's a rather slim part of the Roman Curia that has to carry out this work. And it is largely linguistically focused. What I mean by this is that the Catholic Church has to communicate in all these languages that all of us who work in that department in one way or another are engaged intensively in linguistic work, meaning translating, writing, and so on. So the primary divisions of the Secretariat are by language: French, English, Spanish, Chinese, Japanese, Latin, and so on.
Yeah. What were some of the languages that you knew that kind of maybe got you into that position?
Yeah, that's a good question, Alvaro. So I was first summoned to act under Benedict as an English secretary. Now, that obviously means that I knew some English, which I do, it's my native language, but
A
also,
little bit.
but also, so even though I was in that section, everybody needs to know Italian since that is essentially the functional language of the Roman Curia, and I dare say of the church right now. It's in a way, it's kind of replaced Latin as the functional everyday language. But then you also need to know Latin because that is the official language of the church. And then one other foreign language, at least reading skill. For me, I don't know what that would have been because I consider them all to be rather average to mediocre reading skills in French and German and Spanish. Although German was my first foreign language, so I did have some skills. And that maybe, you're never told, but that maybe have put me on the radar for someone to work for Benedict XVI. So I started out as an English secretary. I worked in that capacity for about 2 years, and then I was transferred because of a need to work primarily in Latin. Again, working in English, still writing, doing speech writing, things like that. But my focus day to day was really the Latin language, and that was simply an internal transfer because of a need. And I spent most of my years in that capacity, working, writing Latin documents. And so on, doing Latin correspondence for, first of all, for Benedict and for Francis.
I read somewhere that you would translate from, I think, English or Spanish into Latin his tweets to like 230,000 of the Latin
Yes.
subscribers. Was that the case?
Yes. So, briefly, this is a very charming story, I think, and one which I really is. I think I've tried to tell this story. And you found it obviously, and I'm happy that you did because it's again, it's sort of kind of shows the quotidian nature of what goes on. So it was Benedict, and not him personally, but his staff, and I think we were part of that. In other words, the Latin section that I was working in, we were aware of the power of social media, and so it was suggested to him that he should launch some kind of a social media channel. Well, extensive research was done, deliberations. Facebook was a candidate. Now, of course, we're going back to, I can't remember the year, but things have changed. You know, this is when Twitter was still in the early days of Twitter, or long before it became X. In any case, it was settled on Twitter for various reasons because it was brief. And it was at least exposed to all kinds of possible, you know, going back and forth and so on. Anyway, so Twitter, and so the way I got involved was that originally it was in six languages, and if I remember correctly, it would have been European languages: French, German, Italian, Spanish, Polish was included. Anyway, it's something else, not Latin. Latin was not included. So we just sat back. That is the Latinists. And didn't raise our voices. We were a little bit disappointed because we thought it would be a lot of fun to. But then we basically got a pile of letters, several piles of letters, you know, almost halfway to the ceiling that we synthesized and got forwarded. These letters were begging for the Pope to tweet in Latin. And Alvaro, I'll tell you that one of the most beautiful things is less than half of them were from Catholics. These are from people throughout the world who knew the importance of Latin. Or just loved it for fun, but they knew of its importance because of his history and so on. And they also were aware that it was the official language of the church. And they said, Your Holiness, why aren't you tweeting in Latin? You're tweeting in all of these languages. So it didn't take much to persuade dear Pope Benedict, because he loved Latin and he could speak it fluently. We would speak with him fluently. That he said, why not? He said, why didn't we, basically, why did we not do this in the first place? I didn't have an answer for that. But so then we started to prepare the tweets in Latin and had great fun doing it. It was a that because that story, I'm glad it was circulated so widely. People are mistaken that we spent most of our time doing that. That was basically about 2% of the way I spent my time was writing tweets. But it was certainly a wonderful respite, and beyond that, it had an enormous impact for handing on and teaching the language. And I used it as a tool in that way.
And 2% of your time, yet maybe reaching thousands more people than in the 98%. And sometimes that's kind of how it is. And sort of like a continuing the language using like almost like this ancient language with this modern means, the marriage there is beautiful.
Yes, and the number of followers, actually, we kept track of it in order to show, because there were still some naysayers that we shouldn't have been, this was the wrong signal or something like that. Again, we already had the piles of letters to kind of demonstrate that this was not the church pushing anything on the world, but the world pushing something on the church. But the number of followers, we were quite proud, I must admit, because we surpassed, I think, Polish and then French. So Latin was rising up there with the number of, I don't know what it's at now. I have no idea. I haven't followed in years. I have to confess there. But in any case, you're right that it had an enormous impact on lots of different levels for people, and tweeting in general from the Pope. It just showed that, you know, the Pope was open to new technology, new ways of communicating.
That's great. Let's get right into Pope Francis. You know, one of the things that I think makes a lot of people sad, I was watching this one video about the sometimes the harsh reactions to him, and maybe it's like the straw man, this harsh reaction to this person that most of us didn't even really get to know, only who was presented to us. When I read your article, it was two stories. One that was about his surprise when this person came with this like fancy way of writing documents, and he thought, let's just do computers. And another one where he was correcting someone's behavior at mass, which maybe people don't even think that he would ever do. And then in the article, it seemed like almost like you had like a plethora of stories that you wish you could share. What are some of those stories were, so we could really get to know, what was he really like? What were some of the things you saw behind the scenes?
Yeah.
That maybe that are memorable, that impress you, that you thought, I wish people, that this is newsworthy. I wish people would talk about this.
Yeah. Good question, Alvaro. So interestingly, with that story, which I'm surprised so many people have been somewhat edified by it, with the two anecdotes, I chose those very randomly because they were, and there was no reason why they should have been, but they were the first two that kind of came into my mind to demonstrate two things. One, I suppose, the story, just to briefly summarize, with those calligraphers and the Pope just being, you know, almost too open and honest at the wrong moment, and these men dedicate their lives to this beautiful handwriting of his documents, which he signs and which go out to the world, and think, oh, why just, you know, why can't we do this on a computer type of thing? And of course, there was just shock. I mean, one, because, well, there are two reasons, you know, they and we realized how rare this was, that someone care, you know, an entity in the world that still care about beautiful handwriting, beautiful calligraphy. Two, these men, their livelihood depended on this. They didn't make much money, but they didn't want to be out of work while the computers were brought into their offices and everything printed in that way. What that showed about Francis I would dare say I have Argentinian friends. I think it's partly an Argentinian trait. Just openness, frankness, right? I mean, kind of like talking before you think. And it's admirable. It is. And Francis would do this behind the scenes and also out in public. I was uncomfortable with it. I don't think he should have done it in a lot of publicly at times. I think it did cause confusion. I really believe that. But, you know, yeah, it's who he was. And so that story was meant to show that. But also the story about him scolding a man who was attending his mass, who was sitting in a lounging position, feet crossed, you know, just arms crossed and sitting back. It was clear that the man was completely unaware of how disrespectful his posture was. But the Pope was really bothered by it. And this was an example when he got in his eyes, that look, a stern look. Oh, the ice would come into the room. And I saw that more than once. But it wasn't so much to illustrate that, but someone who realized that God deserves respect in God's place, in God's house. And I know a lot of people have been angry because they don't think that he gave that message in the way that he celebrated liturgy and the kind of liturgies that he celebrated and so on. That might be true from the outside, but I can assure you that a solemn moment is a solemn moment. And he had many, which he held faithfully, religiously, that is morning prayer, adoration, Holy Mass being the center, and so on. So that was meant to illustrate that. If I could maybe share one other, let me just think of something I could share. In general, I would say, and I recently kind of it just included a picture with one of my stories showing the two of us laughing. He had a great sense of humor and very easy kind of laugh, as did Benedict, which few know. The two of them, as did John Paul. People, that's the one thing that people don't realize about the three of them. So here's a short anecdote of, about Francis. Now I have to remember he was saying the Eucharistic prayer number one. I don't remember if it was 1, 2, 3, or 4, but anyway, with the Eucharistic prayer, he was saying it in Latin. And when he first got elected, he kept mispronouncing. He was saying Dei Para for the God bearer. Dei Para. The accent is Dei Para. And so Francis, we had first met him. We didn't know him. And we had heard that he could be triggered. He could be a little hot sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so the first time we met him, first time a Latinist, there are four of us. There we are. And the Holy Father, big smile on his face. And our leader, wonderful, humble Franciscan friar. He looks at all of us and turns to our leader. And he says in Italian, he says, "How's my Latin?" And the friar just smiled and said, "Well, Father, Holy Father, you've got some problems. You should be saying Dei Para, not Dei Para." And the Holy Father, just his face, because he had said, you know, "How's my Latin?" Not expecting to be corrected there on the spot. His face just fell, an expression that has sometimes been caught on camera like that. And then just slowly smiled and said, "Grazie." Thank you. Grazie, Padre. But the point of this story is the boldness of who had been around much longer than Francis had, the leader of the Latin office. But we didn't know him. And he could have easily reacted otherwise. And, you know, who are you? So I'll share one other brief story to contrast this with. It's also humorous, but it shows a different response to a very similar issue with John Paul II, that he kept signing his name on documents, Johannes Paulus Secundus, with a J, a cursive J rather than an I, because there really is no J in the Latin language, even though orthography does exist for that J. So he had been told, usually by notes, several times, "Your Holiness, there is no J in the Latin language." Well, John Paul could also, he's a saint, but he could also be quite stern. I think that he was doing this at least half in humor, but also to some percentage in a little stubbornness, that he replied one time when, again, it was noted for the 10th time, "Your Holiness, there is no J." He wrote back, "There is now." So that was his response to how it now, the last laugh was gotten by the Latinists. Then if you go to visit his wonderfully prayerful place of rest today in St. Peter's, his tomb, it's an I instead of a J, Johannes Paulus Secundus. But I use that as a contrast to that story of correcting Francis with his Latin. Both of them, wonderful men. One's been canonized. I would have no objections. I know many would if the one that we just lost is canonized someday. But they were very similar in many ways, you know, for all the differences between them.
How are we doing on time, by the way?
Yeah, I have another 5, 6, 7 minutes. Let's say 31, about 6 minutes. Yeah.
Okay. That was one thing that you said. Sometimes people will contrast because they seem, at least kind of from this side of the curtain, to be extremely different. John Paul II, Benedict, and Francis. What are some of the ways, from your perspective, that they were similar?
So one thing that I've noted, tried to draw attention to, is that no matter who that individual is, we have been more than blessed in the fact that they are above all men of prayer and discernment. And they show that with their daily schedule. They all have shown that in different ways. Primarily Holy Mass, Rosary, Scripture reading, obviously, deep Marian devotion, all three of them, no doubt about it. That would be the one commonality. Another was that sense of humor, which I already mentioned. Another would be, I would describe it as a deep, genuine humanity, humanness, whatever you want to call it. They were not afraid to be who they were made to be. No pretense with all three of them. Benedict, too, which it could be the one of the three that someone could say that he seems like he's a bit pretentious. Not at all. He was refined. He was shy. He was a man of ritual, and not just liturgically, but in life. I mean, you could, you know, clock everything he did. John Paul II was probably the least ritualistic as far as his daily schedule and daily life of the three of them. But the point is that they may not have actually stepped onto the balcony. In fact, I know this is probably the case with Benedict. If you watch the footage of him stepping out, and I knew him, I had not begun, I have to make clear, begun working for him yet, but I had met him several times when in my theological studies and so on. He did not look comfortable. And in fact, I would have expected him to not look comfortable stepping out in white. But he learned very quickly, I can just be myself. They elected me. I don't hide anything. My brother cardinals know who I am, right? And all my personality things, I'll just be that person. And he was. The thing that really struck me about Ben, one more thing about all three of them. After John Paul II traveled the world, which he loved to do and was unparalleled, I mean, he spent more time traveling, at least as much time traveling the world, every continent, you know, that he could reach rather than staying at home. Mm-hmm. Nobody really expected Benedict to do that. And there's a commonality. He did. And as someone who was working for him, I was shocked because we would always say when he would come back home, sometimes, in fact, he would say, that's the last one. That's the last one. Francis, he's a homebody. He's a homebody. But he traveled the world. You know, it just as really, they did it out of a sense of mission. That was a commonality in all of them. Along those lines, I would say that with Benedict, now this is known, so I can say it, because his Cardinal Secretary of State at some point, actually Bertone, Cardinal Tacchese Bertone had said it. The timing of his resignation, which was still a surprise even for those of us who were working for him, was clearly related to World Youth Day that was going to take place that year in Brazil. And he did not want to take the overseas trip. His doctor told him, okay, maybe this is the time, you know, maybe this is the one you don't want to take. Although that's not clear. I have to be clear that in fact what the doctor's input was not clear, but it was clear that Benedict, it was just draining on his energies. And that had a lot to do with the timing, was so that someone else could go abroad, quote, go to South America for World Youth Day that year. But again, I would just underline my point, another commonality, very important. They were evangelizers. And to be evangelizers, they decided to get on the plane and just to go out wherever they could to preach the gospel.
To those that maybe just kind of like some last words to, especially, I'm sure you hear, you know, detractors of Pope Francis, what are any things that maybe you want to kind of appeal to them to consider or to think about, so that maybe not necessarily, you know, at some point we can't control what people think of others, but just maybe inviting people to maybe reconsider, hey, maybe you should look at him a little bit differently and think about either the weight of the office or that he was much more than the media presented him. What would you say to those people, so to speak?
Yeah, that's a very good question, Alvaro. So I'll start with two brief things. One is that, and this might seem a bit cynical, but I don't want to be too cynical. If someone is dissatisfied with the way that the Pope is conducting, exercising his office, and maybe feels that he or she has good reason to be dissatisfied, it will pass, right? And this has passed before in the church. There are popes that go down in history as not really being, let's say, conducive to whatever the ministry might have been or the administrative tasks might have been. It will pass. So let it pass. Secondly, working on the inside, you get a bit, I was privileged of a view, they're all human. And I'm working on a piece now that says, that basically is titled, I Don't Want the Next Pope to Be Perfect. And I'll explain why that is, because if we expect that, we're never going to get it. And I would say to those who have a real problem, just take a moment in your hearts and pray and try to show some compassionate sympathy for a man who was in a difficult position. Lastly, for those who had a really hard time with the Pope, I'm with you. A lot of people are with you. There was a lot of unclarity, right? But to be honest, in the end, the Pope, for as important as he is, you know, we have the scriptures, we have the magisterium, we have the catechism, we have things that can guide us for the clarity, and we can rely on them. And it's a problem if the Pope is an outright, you know, public contradiction to basically, you know, scripture tradition. That's a big problem. If he's not, right? But if you're just not quite sure, just give the favor to scripture and tradition in the magisterium, the ordinary magisterium. Those would be the words that I would have. We have a wonderful church. Couldn't be more blessed to be baptized, confirmed, receiving communion every day, and following the Lord. And the Pope is along there with us, and we want him to be a strong leader. We pray that the next one will be, but the church goes on, and it always will.
I think that's really great to kind of see that he's one piece of a puzzle of other, maybe, I don't know if you could say equally important pieces, but maybe very important pieces to think, look, if this is a little bit this way or that way, this is there to supplement and vice versa.
Yes, I think you've expressed it just right, Alvaro. I agree completely. To bottom line, even the Pope knows that too much stock is placed on him, so to speak, in his importance. I'm not undermining the importance. In fact, it's a great gift that we have a successor of Peter, that we have a Peter. But the Pope would be the last one to say that salvation, and the workings of salvation in God's plan and the action of the Holy Spirit depends solely on him, because we're getting by without a Pope right now. And, there have been times in the church has gotten through 2 or 3 years without a clear Pope. So, yeah, but I think you've said it well.
Well, thank you, Daniel, so much for giving us your time and some of these experiences. I wish we could share more. I hope that maybe one day you write a book, as sometimes we've seen this with previous popes. So God bless you in your work and in everything that you do.
Thank you, Alvaro, and God bless you and your wonderful channel and your listeners. I look forward to your content to come. So God bless you.
Okay. Well, for everyone joining us, as I'd like to say, I'll see you in the next one.